Chapter 72. What amiable baronet can escape the effect of a strong desire for a particular possession? Sir Hugo would have been glad that Grandcourt, with or without reason, should prefer any other place to Diplo. But inasmuch as in the pure process of wishing we can always make the conditions of our gratification benevolent, he did wish that Grandcourt's convenient disgust for Diplo should not be associated with his marriage with this very charming bride. Gwendolyn was much to the baronet's taste, but, as he observed afterward to Lady Malinger, he should never have taken her for a young girl who had married beyond her expectations. Deronda had not heard much of this conversation, having given his attention elsewhere, but the glimpses he had of Gwendolyn's manner deepened the impression that it had something newly artificial. Later, in the drawing room, Deronda, at somebody's request, sat down to the piano and sang. Afterward, Mrs. Raymond took his place, and on rising he observed that Gwendolyn had left her seat, and had come to this end of the room, as if to listen more fully, but was now standing with her back to everyone, apparently contemplating a fine cowled head carved in ivory which hung over a small table. He longed to go to her and speak. Why should he not obey such an impulse, as he would have done toward any other lady in the room? Yet he hesitated some moments, observing the graceful lines of her back, but not moving. If you have any reason for not indulging a wish to speak to a fair woman, it is a bad plan to look long at her back. The wish to see what it screens becomes the stronger. There may be a very sweet smile on the other side. Deronda ended by going to the end of the small table, at right angles to Gwendolyn's position, but before he could speak as he had turned on him no smile, but such an appealing look of sadness, so utterly different from the chill effort of her recognition at table, that his speech was checked. For what was an appreciative space of time to both, though the observation of others could not have measured it, they looked at each other, she seeming to take the deep rest of confession, he with an answering depth of sympathy that neutralized all other feelings. "Will you not join in the music?" he said by way of meeting the necessity for speech. That her look of confession had been involuntary was shown by that just perceptible shake and change of countenance with which she roused herself to reply calmly, "I join in it by listening. I am fond of music. Are you not a musician? I have given a great deal of time to music, but I have not talent enough to make it worthwhile. I shall never sing again. But if you are fond of music, it will always be worthwhile in private, for your own delight. I make it a virtue to be content with my middlingness," said Deronda, smiling. "It is always pardonable, so that one does not ask others to take it for superiority." "I cannot imitate you," said Gwendolyn, recovering her tone of artificial vivacity. "To be middling with me is another phrase for being dull. And the worst fault I have to find with the world is that it is dull. Do you know, I am going to justify gambling in spite of you. It is a refuge from dullness." "I don't admit the justification," said Deronda. I think what we call the dullness of things is a disease in ourselves. Else how can anyone find an intense interest in life? And many do." "Ah, I see. The fault I find in the world is my own fault," said Gwendolyn, smiling at him. Then after a moment, looking up at the ivory again, she said, "Do you never find fault with the world or with others?" "Oh, yes. When I am in a grumbling mood." "And hate people?" "Confess you hate them, when they stand in your way, when their gain is your loss. That is your own phrase, you know. We are often standing in each other's way, when we can't help it. I think it is stupid to hate people on that ground." "But if they injure you, and could have helped it?" said Gwendolyn with a hard intensity unaccountable in incidental talk like this. Deronda wondered at her choice of subjects. A painful impression arrested his answer a moment, but at last he said, with a graver, deeper intonation, "Why, then, after all, I prefer my place to theirs. There I believe you are right, said Gwendolyn, with a sudden little laugh, and turned to join the group at the piano. Deronda looked around for Grandcourt, wondering whether he followed his bride's movements with any attention. But it was rather undiscerning to him to suppose that he could find out the fact. Grandcourt had a delusive mood of observing whatever had an interest for him, which could be surpassed by no sleepy-eyed animal on the watch for prey. At that moment he was plunged in the depth of an easy chair, being talked to by Mr. Vandernoot, who apparently thought the acquaintance of such a bridegroom worth cultivating, and an incautious person might have supposed it safe to telegraph secrets in front of him, the common prejudice being that your quick observer is one whose eyes have quick movements. Not at all. If you want a respectable witness who will see nothing inconvenient, choose a vivacious gentleman, very much on the alert, with two eyes wide open, a glass in one of them, and an entire impartiality as to the purpose of looking. If Grandcourt cared to keep anyone under his power, he saw them out of the corners of his long narrow eyes, and if they went behind him, he had a constructive process by which he knew what they were doing there. He knew perfectly well where his wife was, and how she was behaving. Was he going to be a jealous husband? Deronda imagined that to be likely, but his imagination was as much astray about Grandcourt as it would have been about an unexplored continent, where all the species were peculiar. He did not conceive that he himself was a likely subject of jealousy, or that he should give any pretext for it. But the suspicion that a wife is not happy naturally leads one to speculate on the husband's private deportment, and Deronda found himself after 1 o'clock in the morning in the rather ludicrous position of sitting up severely holding a Hebrew grammar in his hands, for somehow, in deference to Mordecai, he had begun to study Hebrew with the consciousness that he had been in that attitude nearly an hour, and had thought of nothing but Gwendolyn and her husband. To be an unusual young man means, for the most part, to get a difficult mastery over the usual, which is often like the sprite of ill luck you pack up your goods to escape from, and see grinning at you from the top of your luggage van. The peculiarities of Deronda's nature had been acutely touched by the brief incident and words which made the history of his intercourse with Gwendolyn, and this evening's slight addition had given them an importunate recurrence. It was not vanity, it was ready sympathy, that had made him alive to a certain appealingness in her behavior toward him, and the difficulty with which as he had seemed to raise her eyes to bow to him, in the first instance, was to be interpreted now by that unmistakable look of involuntary confidence which as he had afterward turned on him under the consciousness of his approach. What is the use of it all? Thought Deronda, as he threw down his grammar and began to undress. I can't do anything to help her, nobody can, if as he has found out her mistake already. And it seems to me that she has a dreary lack of the ideas that might help her. Strange and piteous to human flesh like that might be, wrapped round with fine raiment, her ears pierced for gems, her head held loftily, her mouth all smiling pretense, the poor soul within her sitting in sick distaste of all things. But what do I know of her? There may be a demon in her to match the worst husband, for what I can tell. She was clearly an ill-educated worldly girl. Perhaps she is a coquette. This last reflection, not much believed in, was a self-administered dose of caution, prompted partly by Sir Hugo's much-contumed joking on the subject of flirtation. Deronda resolved not to volunteer any tete-a-tete with Gwendolyn during the days of her stay at the Abbey, and he was capable of keeping a resolve in spite of much inclination to the contrary. But a man cannot resolve about a woman's actions, least of all about those of a woman like Gwendolyn, in whose nature there was a combination of proud reserve with rashness, of perilously poised terror with defiance, which might alternately flatter and disappoint control. Few words could less represent her than coquette. As he had native love of homage, and belief in her own power, but no cold artifice for the sake of enslaving. And the poor thing's belief in her power, with her other dreams before marriage, and often to be thrust aside now like the toys of a sick child, which it looks at with dull eyes, and has no heart to play with, however it may try. The next day at lunch Sir Hugo said to her, "The thaw has gone on like magic, and it's so pleasant out of doors just now. Shall we go and see the stables, and the other odd bits about the place?"
"Yes, pray," said Gwendolyn.
"Why, you will like to see the stables, Henley," she added, looking at her husband.
"Uncommonly," said Grandcourt, with an indifference which seemed to give irony to the word, as he returned her look. It was the first time Deronda had seen them speak to each other since their arrival, and he thought their exchange of looks as cold, or official as if it had been a ceremony, to keep up a charter. Still, the English fondness for reserve will account for much negation, and Grandcourt's manners with an extra veil of reserve over them might be expected to present the extreme type of the national taste. Who else is inclined to make the tour of the house and premises?" said Sir Hugo. "Tea, the ladies must muffle themselves. There is only just about time to do it well before sunset. You will go, Dan, won't you?"
"Oh, yes," said Deronda, carelessly, knowing that Sir Hugo would think any excuse disobliging.
"I'll meet in the library then, when they are ready, say in half an hour," said the baronet. Gwendolyn made herself ready with wonderful quickness, and in 10 minutes came down into the library in her sables, plume, and little thick boots. As soon as she entered the room she was aware that someone else was there. It was precisely what she had hoped for. Deronda was standing with his back toward her at the far end of the room, and was looking over a newspaper. How could little thick boots make any noise on the Axminster carpet? And to cough would have seemed an intended signaling which her pride could not condescend to. Also, she felt bashful about walking up to him and letting him know that she was there, though it was her hunger to speak to him which had set her imagination on constructing this chance of finding him, and had made her hurry down, as birds hover near the water which they dare not drink. Always uneasily dubious about his opinion of her, she felt a peculiar anxiety today, lest he might think of her with contempt, as one triumphantly conscious of being Grandcourt's wife, the future lady of this domain. It was her habitual effort now, to magnify the satisfactions of her pride, on which she nourished her strength. But somehow Deronda's being there disturbed them all. There was not the faintest touch of coquetry in the attitude of her mind toward him. He was unique to her among men, because he had impressed her as being not her admirer but her superior. In some mysterious way he was becoming a part of her conscience, as one woman whose nature is an object of reverential belief may become a new conscience to a man. And now he would not look round and find out that she was there. The paper crackled in his hand, his head rose and sank, exploring those stupid columns, and he was evidently stroking his beard, as if this world were a very easy affair to her. Of course all the rest of the company would soon be down, and the opportunity of her saying something to efface her flippancy of the evening before would be quite gone. She felt sick with irritation so fast the young creatures like her absorb misery through invisible suckers of their own fancies, and her face had gathered that peculiar expression which comes with a mortification to which tears are forbidden. At last he threw down the paper and turned round. "Oh, you are there already," he said, coming forward a step or two, "colon I must go and put on my coat."
He turned aside and walked out of the room. This was behaving quite badly. Mere politeness would have made him stay to exchange some words before leaving her alone. It was true that Grandcourt came in with Sir Hugo immediately after, so that the words must have been too few to be worth anything. As it was, they saw him walking from the library door.
"You look rather ill," said Grandcourt, going straight up to her, standing in front of her, and looking into her eyes.
"Do you feel equal to the walk?"
"Yes, I shall like it," said Gwendolyn, without the slightest movement except this of the lips.
"We could put off going over the house, you know, and only go out of doors," said Sir Hugo,
kindly, while Grandcourt turned aside.
Oh, dear no, said Gwendolyn, speaking with determination. Let us put off nothing. I want a long walk. The rest of the walking party, two ladies, and two gentlemen besides Deronda, had now assembled, and Gwendolyn, rallying, went with due cheerfulness by the side of Sir Hugo, paying apparently an equal attention to the commentaries Deronda was called upon to give on the various architectural fragments, to Sir Hugo's reasons for not attempting to remedy the mixture of the undisguised modern with the antique, which in his opinion only made the place the more truly historical. On their way to the buttery and kitchen, they took the outside of the house, and paused before a beautiful pointed doorway, which was the only old remnant in the east front. Well, now, to my mind, said Sir Hugo, that is more interesting, standing as it is in the middle of what is frankly four centuries later, than if the whole front had been dressed up in a pretense of the 13th century. Additions ought to smack of the time when they are made, and carry the stamp of their period. I wouldn't destroy any old bits, but that notion of reproducing the old is a mistake, I think. At least, if a man likes to do it, he must pay for his whistle. Besides, where are you to stop along that road making loopholes, where you don't want to peep, and so on? You may as well ask me to wear out the stones with kneeling. Eh, Grandcourt? A confounded nuisance, drawled Grandcourt. I hate fellows wanting to howl litanies, acting the greatest bores that have ever existed. Well, yes, that's what their romanticism must come to, said Sir Hugo, in a tone of confidential assent, had as if they carry it out logically. I think that way of arguing against a course, because it may be ridden down to an absurdity, would soon bring life to a standstill, said Deronda. It is not the logic of human action, but of a roasting jack, that must go on to the last turn, when it has been once wound up. We can do nothing safely without some judgment as to where we are to stop. I find the rule of the pocket the best guide, said Sir Hugo, laughingly. And as for most of your new old building, you had need to hire men to scratch and chip it all over artistically, to give it an elderly-looking surface, which at the present rate of labor would not answer. Do you want to keep up the old fashions, then, Mr. Deronda? Said Gwendolyn, taking advantage of the freedom of grouping to fall back a little, while Sir Hugo and Grandcourt went on. Some of them. I don't see why we should not use our choice there as we do elsewhere, or why either age or novelty by itself is an argument for or against. To delight in doing things, because our fathers did them, as good, if it shuts out nothing better. It enlarges the range of affection, and affection is the broadest basis of good in life. Do you think so? Said Gwendolyn with a little surprise. I should have thought you cared most about ideas, knowledge, wisdom, and all that. But to care about them is a sort of affection, said Deronda, smiling at her sudden naivety. See, call it attachment. Interest, willing to bear a great deal for the sake of being with them, and saving them from injury. Of course, it makes a difference if the objects of interest are human beings, but generally in all deep affections the objects are a mixture, half persons and half ideas. Sentiments and affections flow in together. I wonder whether I understand that, said Gwendolyn, putting up her chin in her old saucy manner. I believe I am not very affectionate. Perhaps you mean to tell me that is the reason why I don't see much good in life. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.